Hey, y'all, welcome back to Her with Amina Brown. And yes, people, we are a week away from Election Day. In some ways, I want to say we made it. In other ways, I want to say, even though we got a week, we still got a long way to go, okay? So this is your friendly voting reminder. Hopefully, you have already voted, maybe through early voting or mailing in your ballot by now. But if you haven't, this is your reminder to do so. Make sure you get out and vote or stay home and vote. But whatever you do, vote. It's very important in every election to vote, especially important in this election. Make sure you do it. So, as a woman, I have been asked quite a few inappropriate questions. And not too long ago, prior to the pandemic, I was asked a very inappropriate question in a professional setting. And this just made me think about what are the things that you should never ask a woman? And I thought, instead of just including my own narrative, I put it out there to my social media community to ask people to tell me one thing that you should never ask a woman. So I want to go through these because I want to share your responses. And I'm hoping if there is anyone listening that you hear a question you have asked in this list, that you will learn today to never ask those things of a woman. Question number one, is that your hair? Never ask a woman, is that your hair? If she decides she wants to tell you, then maybe she will. If she bought it, it's all her hair. Question two, what she wants to eat. I feel a little attacked by this question. And my husband is the producer of this podcast. And I feel attacked that when I said that out loud, he turned to look at me. I feel attacked because, you know what? I'm going to skip to the next question. Question three. This is a combination of questions along the same lines. Why are you single? Why are you still single? And why aren't you married? Stop asking people about their relationship status. If they want to share it with you, then they will. But stop asking them about it. I think sometimes I'm wondering, is the problem that people just are not good at conversation or are even not good at small talk? And I get it. Some people, you know, you just hate small talk. But a lot of these questions are coming up in some small talk situations. So I do want to provide some suggestions at the end of this of things you could ask other than these questions. But I have to say also, these questions do not just come from strangers. Sometimes they also come from people that you know, but they're asking you this question in a setting that is not like, you know, you and your best friend were talking and your best friend's like, I don't even know, but I'm saying that. And I'm like, I don't even know that a best friend would ever be like, why are you still single? A best friend might say, how's your dating life going? Right? Don't ask these questions. Why are you single? Why are you still single? Why aren't you married? Don't ask those questions. Question number four, were you born a woman? I want to, do not ask these questions ever. Question five, a combination here. Can you calm down and why are you so emotional? In the history of women womaning, it has never helped a woman relax by asking her if she can calm down. And I resent the question, why are you so emotional? Because I think there's this insinuation there that to be emotional is to be a weakness. And to be emotional is actually a great strength and can be a great strength. But if other people don't know how to handle their emotions, then sometimes they project onto you that you are what? Too emotional, or that you have too many feelings. I think anytime the word too in the T-O-O is placed in front of a word regarding a woman, it's not a jam. Too emotional, too thick, too big, too tall, too short, too whatever that is. You're not too anything. You are who you are in the fullness of that. Don't ever ask a woman these things. Also, let's just cover, I'm covering all the pregnancy and child questions right here. Do not ask a woman, when are you due? Are you pregnant? Is there a baby in there? That one really makes me mad. Why don't you have kids? When are you going to have a baby? When are you going to have another baby? Let's stop and have a moment right here. Just in general, if you see a woman, I don't care if she has a stomach that looks like she's carrying another adult in there. You keep your eyes on the road. You keep your eyes in her eyes. You don't ask her anything unless she says the words to you, I am pregnant. She says the words to you, I would like to talk to you about my pregnancy. Because even I am pregnant is not an invitation to have further conversation with her about her body. So she would basically have to say a paragraph of things to you. I'm pregnant. And I would love to talk to you as a stranger about the myriad details of my pregnancy. Please ask me a question. If you ever hear that from a woman, go on. Ask her, is there a baby in there? Ask her all these questions. Don't ask her, when is she going to have another baby? And let me just give a little PSA right here. You don't know the story that a woman may have behind pregnancy, fertility, loss. You don't know any of those things. So these questions that people might assume are small talk, are innocent questions, are never innocent questions. And I just want to yell from the rooftops, never ask a woman these questions. And I just want to say, if you're listening and you have been asked these questions, I think it's well within your rights to just go ahead and come up with an equally uncomfortable response. You know, like I'm still trying to think through this. There was somebody on my Facebook page who said whenever someone would ask her why she doesn't have kids or when she's going to have kids, she would say to them, when was the last time you had sex? And they would get like super uncomfortable right there. I think you should definitely come up with an answer right there. So far, one of the ones I'm sticking with is if someone is asking me, why don't I have kids? If they want to know when I'm going to try, am I trying, all those things. My replacement question for them is I'm going to ask them, have they had sex with a bear? And I feel like that's an equally important question to ask. You know, like if you can ask me what my genitalia or my other reproductive organs are doing, then I should be able to point the question back to you. And if you feel uncomfortable answering, then you should feel uncomfortable asking me. Do not inquire about what anyone's genitalia or reproductive organs are doing. Do not inquire. Next question. What's your cup size? This question really sent me, like I was commenting with people a little bit when I was asking this question, and I can't imagine a situation I would be in where someone who I don't know well or who I don't feel comfortable with would ask me my cup size. I just, okay. Next, this question is a banger. Is it that time of the month? I'll tell you the truth. First of all, periods have been blamed for quite a few things that are really the fault of sexism. And I stand by that. I mean, I can remember times in high school that I would, you know, be overhearing a conversation where, you know, a girl is getting mad about a particular thing. And it's a guy looking at her saying more than likely a phrase like this or similar to, are you on the rag, right? I know I'm not the only person who remembers these types of phrases too. So is it that time of the month? Maybe it is, but whatever it is none of your business. Whatever time of the month is none of your business. And also, periods get thrown under the bus when periods are just fine. Periods are happening to probably more than half of the population of the world, okay? Periods are normal. Periods are fine. There's nothing wrong with a woman having a time of the month. But also, there is this insinuation, right, that because a woman is having her, air quotes, time of the month, or because a person is having their, air quotes, time of the month, right, that means that person is wilding out, they're angry, they can't handle their feelings and emotions. And yet, we see men in leadership all over America who do not have an, air quotes, time of the month, and yet manage to be irrational and manage to make decisions based solely on their feelings. But no one's asking them, is it their testicles time of the month? Okay, let's go on. Next question. Asking a lesbian couple who is the man in the relationship. If you have asked this question, I hope this is your warning. Do not do that ever, ever again. Never ask a woman or a lesbian couple this question. Next question. This question actually is opening up with what is supposed to sound like a compliment, and then it's not, right? You look good. Have you lost weight? What? Also, have you gained weight? Either of these questions regarding weight are not on the table of questions to ask, okay? First of all, whatever a person is doing with their weight is whatever they want to do with it. You don't get to comment whether they lost it or they gained it. And sometimes, isn't it interesting that in these conversations regarding lost weight or gained weight, that there can be, depending on your cultural background, right, there can be particular value placed on whether you've lost weight or you gained weight, right? Like, I remember there would be times that we would get together for our family reunion, and most of my family is from North Carolina. So we'd all get together for like a family reunion. And if you had not been around the family in a while, there was typically some commentary on your weight, right? There was typically this comment of either, baby, have you been eating? Do you even eat any food? You're wasting away, right? Or there would be this comment to say, ooh, baby, you done got large. You done got huge. I mean, you know, you can be in these situations, not just with strangers, but even with your family members. People, don't comment on people's weight, okay? Don't do that. There's no reason why you need to have that discussion. And we don't need to place value upon losing or gaining weight. We don't want to place value on people based on their body. We want to place value on them based on who they are. We want to accept them in all of the ways their body represents itself. Okay, boom. Next. Oh, does the carpet match the drapes? I understand that people feel, you know, very interested in home decor because of HGTV. I understand that, you know, you're interested in what other people are doing with their shiplap. But look, you save those questions for when it's somebody's actual house. You don't need to be worried about nobody's carpet, nobody's drapes, nobody's valance, whatever. You don't need to be worried, vellum. You don't need to be worried about any of that on anybody's body, okay? You save that for some show on renovation. You don't do that when you're talking to someone. And hey, if a person gives you permission to see the carpet or see the drapes, then you'll find out. But if you're not in a situation where they're giving you permission to know what the drapes or the carpet or the wallpaper are doing, you don't need to be worried about it, okay? Next question. How many people have you slept with? I just tire of the ways that people are wearing us out with these questions. How many people have you slept with? I just have to go back to a very basic junior high answer, and the answer is Nunya. And yes, Nunya is a number. Nunya is an amount. It is quantified. Nunya is to say never. It is a long amount of time. Nunya involves a lot of enumeration. And Nunya is basically saying, whatever the number is, it's what? None of your business. Thank you, Salt and Pepper, for reminding us about that. Okay. It's none of your business. You don't need to know about that. If a person chooses to share that with you, they share it. But you don't need to be asking it. You don't need to know about that. Okay. Next. Why don't you smile more? It is not our job as women to entertain. It is not our job as women to have to make people comfortable. We smile when we want to smile. And when we don't want to smile, we don't. So you don't need to be quantifying or measuring how much I smile. You need to be worried about why don't I smile more, okay? In general, I want to remind everyone, don't ask questions about a woman's body. Don't ask questions regarding her period. Don't ask questions about things that are a woman's personal business that don't have nothing to do with you. And I want to give honorable mention. These three things were not questions, but they were brought up a couple of times as I was talking to people from social media. These three statements are also things you should never say to a woman. Number one, you look tired. What am I supposed to do with that information? You tell me I look tired. What am I supposed to do? At the moment you say it to me, I'm supposed to go lay down, take a nap somewhere. Like, what? I look tired. Maybe I am tired, but maybe I'm not. And now you told me I look tired. What is the point of it? Don't say it. Number two, hush. I'm going to also add to this, shh. Mm-mm. Unless you're a librarian and I'm in the library making noise where there were clearly signs that stated, don't talk in here, you should not be telling a woman to hush or shush. And lastly, you should not be telling a woman to calm down. And it's not going to work, actually. It's not a good tactic. Just like when a woman is angry or upset, how men in the movies always kiss her. Terrible tactic, okay? Don't do these things. What are things that you can say instead when you are looking to just have small talk in a personal or professional situation? Maybe you find yourself at, you know, the hors d'oeuvres table next to a woman. You just wanted to say hello. There are thousands of other questions that are not these, such as, what is her favorite fruit snack? You can also ask her, where did she get those shoes? You can also ask her, what is one fun thing she did this week? I just gave you three questions that are great, that will actually help you get to know this person, that are avoiding things that are what? None of your business. Okay? This ends my PSA of things you should never ask a woman. This week, I was thinking a lot about a question that a friend of mine asked me a few months ago. She asked me, in my life, what are the books that have most influenced, encouraged me in my Black womanhood? And it's a really interesting question to think about. I don't know how many of you are avid readers or loved reading even as a kid, but I was totally like that. I loved reading as a kid. And thinking about sort of the books that become these different landmark readings in your life, that you remember getting a hold of that book and what it meant to you to find yourself or see yourself on the page. And just recently, there have been obviously a lot of conversation right now about how we can be supporting Black creatives and Black authors included in that, and how to uplift the stories that Black people are telling, and in particular, that Black women are telling. And so I wanted to lift up a few of the books that have meant the world to me in my Black girl and Black woman journey. And I hope that for my Black women listeners, that if you have not read some of these books, maybe you will also be encouraged to read them and check them out, some of them to reread, as some of them are books that I reread at certain different times. And for my listeners who are not Black women, that hearing some of the titles of these books or authors of these books would also be helpful for you as you are thinking about how you can engage more in supporting and learning from the work of Black women. First book on my list is For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough by Ntozake Shange. I actually saw this choreo poem as a play before I read it on its pages. I saw it as a play when I was in college at Spelman College, and it was and still is one of the most beautiful pieces of performance art I've ever seen. And then it was years later that I actually purchased the book and got to read it and reread it and reread it. It influences me so much as a poet who is writing work to perform on stage and reading the amazing things that Ntozake Shange was able to do with these words that I experienced powerfully in both forms. I experienced it powerfully as a stage play and experienced it powerfully in its reading. I do want to say, if you have watched the For Colored Girls film that Tyler Perry made, I do highly encourage you to also buy the book and read the words that Ntozake Shange wrote. They are so powerful. And as happens, the movies and films do not always or cannot always really contain all the amazing things that are in a book. And this book, highly recommend. Second book on my list, these are not in any particular order. Second book on my list is The Color Purple by Alice Walker, which also became a film and also became a Broadway play, right? So I would encourage you, if you can and are able to experience The Color Purple in all three forums. You'll find different parts of the book highlighted in a certain way in the film, highlighted in different ways in the play and musical. The Color Purple was a book I read, I think, in eighth grade. I was actually reading The Color Purple and this other book called The Awakening, and I was writing a paper on them both. But The Color Purple being at that time reading it so young, starting out, if you've never read The Color Purple, the first few pages of The Color Purple are some of the rawest fiction that you may have ever read. It is a very raw story. And I do want to give trigger warnings about that very raw story of abuse and assault very early on in this book. If you are able to continue on as Alice Walker unfolds this story, which is a story full of letter writing, and some of that letter writing is from Celie, the central character, to God. Later, as the story progresses, those letters are between Celie and her sister, Nettie. There's a whole lexicon of things that come from The Color Purple for so many Black women in America, but The Color Purple is such a quintessential work for me because I remember reading that novel as a junior high student. I don't know if that was too young or not, but I was reading it. I remember reading it again later, maybe when I was in college. I think I was in my 20s, maybe late 20s, when I saw the musical on Broadway. The one that I went to see, Fantasia, was starring as Celie. And also, obviously, I watched the movie many times. There are certain parts of that movie that I know almost by heart. And I reread the book not too long ago. And this time in reading it, what really struck me is the strong sense of spirituality in that book. And there are different things that I feel that book showed me, even about God and sort of the role of God in that story, the role of God in my own life. It was really interesting to read that and sort of read through this lens of Black woman spirituality. Highly recommend The Color Purple. And one other book that I'll recommend to you all, I obviously have a list of bunches and bunches of these, but one of my more recent reads is Sisters of the Yam by Bell Hooks. I actually started to read Sisters of the Yam during a time that I was really going through a difficult time in my health. And I had had this major, major surgery, required a long recovery time for me anyway. It was 6 to 8 weeks. That was a long time for me at that time in my life to just focus on sitting still and getting well. And I started reading Sisters of the Yam then, and I mean, there's a lot to say about Bell Hooks. Anything that you see Bell Hooks' name on, I think, is worthy reading. Sisters of the Yam was really a healing text for me, helped me to really learn, as I'm continuing to learn, about what radical self-care looks like, what it looks like to love yourself, actually. And she really goes into the different systems that are in place that do not make it easy or make it simple even for Black women to love themselves. So big shout out to Bell Hooks. She is a wonderful author and a writer and thinker to read, but I highly recommend Sisters of the Yam. Now I'll add one more. My other one, which is sort of like a gateway book into this writer, is I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And I say that because I remember when that book was a part of Oprah's book club and Oprah talking about what it meant to her to read those first few lines of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And I remember reading it and having grown up in church and having that sort of Easter speech moment. But I say that I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings is a gateway because once you start that book, then you're opening yourself up to this whole world of the work of Dr. Maya Angelou. And as a poet, Dr. Angelou obviously highly influenced me and the work that I'm doing today. Some of her work were early things that I memorized, memorizing Phenomenal Woman for an oratorical contest that my church growing up used to do every Black History Month, and memorizing Still I Rise. So not only is Dr. Angelou's poetry amazing, but her autobiographical series that begins with I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings and goes on for several books. I think that's a wonderful gateway to start with and just read and read and read until you've read through all of her books. I do want to also give a special shout out to Phenomenal Woman. I watched a new movie recently called Miss Juneteenth. Miss Juneteenth is a pageant in the story of this film, and the daughter of the central character is memorizing Phenomenal Woman to perform in the movie. And the mother has also memorized it. And that just totally resonated with me because that's a huge part of my history to have memorized Dr. Maya Angelou's work and really her work on stage teaching me in its own way how to eventually become comfortable with my own writing voice. So those are a few books I would recommend, books I would say have been really quintessential for me in my upbringing. So I would encourage you dig into these works. And if any of my listeners having suggestions for me, especially my Black woman listeners, you have suggestions for me of other Black womanhood books that you would love for me to shout out here, please let me know. Reach out to me on socials. I'd love to hear it. Okay, so for this week's podcast, we are doing a new segment, but it will be recurring. I'll come back and do this every now and then. This segment is called Ask Amina. And if you have questions you want to ask me, it could be questions you want to know about me, you want to know about just life or macaroni and cheese. We can also talk about that. If you have things that you might like advice on, I will also take those. You can use the hashtag AskAmina and I can answer your questions that way. So I've got a few questions from social media. So let's dive in. Which dance movie gives you life? Okay, I feel like I'm about to disappoint with this answer because I don't really have a favorite dance movie. I actually don't. There are very few like musicals or dance movies that I like. I know some, I just lost a listener probably right now. They were like, psh, no, I'm out of here. I don't need to listen to her anymore. I will tell you one of my favorite dance scenes. And I'm like, does this count as a dance scene? I think it does. And I don't know if this is actually in the category of dance movie because so many other things were going on. But Spike Lee's movie School Days, which was this exploration of historically Black college and university life, has a scene in this hair salon that is probably one of my favorite dance scenes. So if you haven't seen School Days, you need to see it. But if you have seen School Days, you know immediately what I'm talking about. I'm so sorry that that's the only answer I have for you there. But if you have dance movie suggestions for me, I'd love to hear them. Next question says, when will we have donuts together again? Like you and I and the royal we. This is from my friend Audrey. Audrey, thank you. Audrey, you and I need to figure out how we're going to have donuts together again. It's first of all, it's really hard for me and my anxiety to try to figure out how to meet up with my friends, especially those that have been doing a good job social distancing. It's hard to find ways to meet up with them and eat, right? Because it's like any other activity, if we were to, you know, go for a walk outside together, if we were to just sit on each other's porches, like socially distanced, like that's fine. But it's like when you bring food and drink into it, I just start getting like, I still haven't figured that out. I've had a couple of, you know, little gatherings where I've tried this, but it's hard to figure out because it's like, okay, I got to take this mask down and eat some food. And then at some point, I got to put the mask back up because I can't like enjoy a donut or sit and drink coffee with you with my mask up. And yeah, like many of you, I saw the clip where there was like a mask designed where it had some sort of apparatus in it where you could keep your mask on and somehow still eat. And it just grossed me out, y'all. And I can't. So when will we get to have donuts together again? Audrey, I hope we figure out a way to do it soon. The royal we, when will we have donuts together again? I don't know. I feel like our safest bet is to get our own collective donuts and have some sort of Zoom donut eating. That's like the best. Otherwise, I don't know. You have to find some sort of like 6 foot long table and you and your friends sit at the ends of it. I wonder if that's going to happen eventually. Well, first of all, we hope we're not in the pandemic long enough for this to happen, but I don't know. The way that things are being handled right now makes me feel like we're going to be in this for a while. So I'm like, I don't know if coffee shops are going to like get rid of the little small circle tables where it was like really intimate for you to like go there on a date or sit there with your friend and talk. Like, is it going to turn into like all the tables in coffee shops are like 6 feet long, all those long, like farmer looking tables, except now instead of like eight people being able to sit there, only two people sit there and they sit at either end. I just don't know. All that to say, let us talk about donuts because this is very important. I'm a big fan of donuts. I will share with you all that I have a passion project that I do with my sister-in-law. We have a pop-up podcast called Here for the Donuts. And I say pop-up because it basically pops up when she and I actually have time to record it. So we haven't posted a new one in a while, but you can go there and listen to the archives of that and hear all of the amazing donut places we've been to. I want to give a shout out to my favorite donut place in Atlanta, Revolution Donuts. They're my favorite place. They are the place that my friend Audrey and I love to get donuts as well. So what is your favorite donut place? I'd love to hear from y'all. Tell me more about that. All right, next question. Somebody's trying to get vulnerable today. How do you keep going and keep your heart soft? Woo. That's deep. That's a deep question today. How do you keep going and keep your heart soft? I think the name of the game for me, I probably would never describe it as like keeping my heart soft, but I think what that phrase sounds like to me is like, how do you remain open? How do you remain vulnerable even in the middle of times, whether collectively or personally, that would, you know, cause you to have a heart that's hardened or cause you to not remain open to things, to people, etc. I think a part of that for me is really the phrase that came to my mind first is self-care. And I know when we hear that phrase, sometimes, you know, this is the same for me too. Like, it's like I hear that phrase and I immediately start like rolling my eyes, like, I don't want to hear about any more bath bombs. But as an aside, I actually really love bath bombs. But, you know, I think when we hear self-care, we just think like, we think about baths and facials and all sorts of things like that. But for me, self-care encompasses quite a few things. It, right now in this season of my life, includes therapy. I think that's one thing that keeps my heart open and soft is having a place to talk to a professional about the things that I am processing mentally and emotionally. Having someone who's objective, who doesn't have any personal skin in the game in my life, that can hear what's underneath the things that I might be thinking or the patterns that I have in my life, that's been really helpful. Having a squad of wonderful women friends is also something that has kept my heart very open and soft. Because when you have good and deep friendships, I mean, for me, that is very much, you know, my women friendships, but whatever those friendships, you know, look like for you, just having people that you don't have to put on for them. You can tell them your insecurities. You can tell them where you're struggling. You can tell them your petty thoughts, you know, and really be vulnerable and be yourself, whether yourself feels beautiful that day, whether yourself feels not so beautiful that day, whatever. And I think having people like that in my life has been really helpful. I would say my husband also, and my husband and I were friends before we were ever together romantically. We were actually like chatting about that before we started recording. And I think having a spouse and a partner in life that I can really be who I am with, you know, I live in the same house with him, but I can also be at home with him. That's a big help for me. I've been thinking a lot about what my spiritual practice looks like in this season of life. And I mean, for me, I am a Christian. I'm a part of the Christian tradition. And I have been examining a lot of like, well, what are my spiritual practices, you know, within my faith context? And what are some new spiritual practices that are maybe things that I didn't grow up with in my faith context, but are wonderful spiritual practices for me? So gospel music, is a big one for me. Some of those songs just still are just in the core of my soul and help remind me that there is a life and a world and God that's bigger than I am. That's something that helps keep my heart soft. I am just ankle deep in meditation. I'm very new to meditation. I haven't gotten to the point where I'm doing meditation unassisted. I've been doing guided meditation, and I've been using, there are two apps that I really love. I love the Headspace app, and I love the Shine app as well. And I especially love the Shine app because I'm getting to hear the voices of women of color on there guiding meditation and different sleep stories and things like that. So meditation's been really helpful for me in keeping my heart soft because it is something that helps me remain grounded and centered. It's a place where I can come back to focusing on my breath and things like that. So that's been really important for me. So those are a few things that are really keeping me going right now, keeping my heart soft. And of course, you know, finding ways to laugh and finding the things that bring me joy. I love cooking. I love cooking really for the mindfulness. I think sometimes cooking itself or baking can be a spiritual practice. I've been watching a lot more comedies lately just to remind myself to laugh and be silly. I'll tell you something else that my husband and I have been doing. I don't know if y'all have been watching Cobra Kai on Netflix. I love Cobra Kai. It's everything. And it's probably everything to me in particular because I also was a Karate Kid fan. I never took karate as a kid or anything like that, but I loved Karate Kid, the whole series. I loved it. So when my husband and I went back to watch Cobra Kai, it's just like this wonderful moment where you're getting to see like whatever happened to Daniel-san, okay? So one thing that we've been doing is whenever there's a fight scene in Cobra Kai, we stand up and we do our own karate kicks and we yell, hi-ya, hi-ya, hi-ya. And I'm going to tell you, if you have an argument with your spouse, you have a fight with your partner, y'all have talked it out, and then y'all get to the point where like there's really nothing else to say in the argument. And it's just that awkward air where like you've either resolved it or you've resolved as much as you can, you know, in a conversation, but you still just have the awkward air and you need to deal with it. Listen, give yourself three karate kicks and yell hi-ya three times. Totally gets rid of the awkward air. I'm here giving y'all relationship tips, okay? Please. Next question. Do you ever struggle with putting yourself, your work out for all to see and judge? Okay, I'm going to answer these two separately regarding putting yourself and then putting your work out there, because I'll say those two are kind of different for me. So regarding putting my work out there, do I ever struggle with it? Absolutely. As I've grown older, matured as a writer, I feel like my work gets more and more vulnerable because I am becoming more and more comfortable with really being myself. So there have been several pieces that I've written, in particular, more and more in the last several years, that I have felt really nervous to put out there because they were so vulnerable. I wrote a poem called Mothers of Invisible Children that was about my experience with miscarriage. And I remember the first time I ever performed, well, I wouldn't say performed that piece. It's such a vulnerable piece. I always read it. It would be too hard and too emotional even to memorize for me. But I remember I was performing at one of our local open mics. I was the feature artist for one of the events. And I don't know why, but that poem was really like in my mind leading up to the event. And I just decided to start my set with it and to hold space for people that had experienced miscarriage, to hold space for people that had experienced just grief and loss overall. And so there is this struggle, especially for me as a poet, in putting out work that is very vulnerable, because sometimes as a poet, I'm writing about TV sitcoms, or I'm writing about all the things I think are amazing about being a Black girl. You know, those poems I don't as much struggle putting out there because they're not vulnerable in the same way as if I'm telling something that is a hard story for me. So a lot of times I will say, for me as a writer, I've learned that it's okay for me to write something vulnerable and that it may not be for the public. I have many poems that never see the light of day as far as anyone else seeing them, but it doesn't mean they were any less important to write. And then there are things that I have written for my own private processing. And then those things get to a point where I realize this is something that I think may help someone else or help someone else feel seen or known or understood. And that makes it important to share in public. So I think I do a lot of processing about the work that I do share, and I make decisions about what's private and what's public. And I have to say, I worry less about how the work will be judged once I've come to peace with why I put it out there. So I think that's one of the things that I guess helps me in that struggle is knowing what is the purpose that makes me want to put out this work. And the purpose, in a lot of cases for me, will override whatever criticism or judgment could come from it. Now, let me go back to this question, considering it not just about my work, but about myself. Do you ever struggle with putting yourself out there for all to see and judge? And I probably struggle with that for myself even more than my work, because as a writer, you're constantly drafting and editing. By the time a piece comes out in the public, I'm not a person that writes a first draft and then that night puts it out there. Like if I put something out there in the public, it's gone through a lot of drafting, which has given me time to process what I'm saying, to process if I stand for what I said and all those things. Whereas when you are just out in the world and society being yourself, you know, you're not always able to process it all and do all these edits, you know, to yourself. You just are who you are. So yes, I do struggle with putting myself out there for people to see and judge, you know, other reasons to be in therapy, because I do talk to my therapist about that, that there are a lot of ways that my own inner voice is very judgmental of myself. So sometimes it's not even just the struggle of how other people will judge me. It's also the struggle of how I inwardly judge myself. So a lot of my, you know, inner healing work in therapy, and honestly in prayer and in my relationships to, you know, my family and my friends who have really, you know, helped me in the healing process of learning to love and accept who I am and be fully who I am. And of course, time and age, you know, for me has helped with that too. I just probably care less at this stage of life than maybe I would have 10 years ago, as far as, you know, feeling like I need to make myself something else for other people. I think all of those spaces are very helpful for me in being who I am. And I think in a way, accepting that people will judge and they will criticize. I remember I was in, not with my current therapist, but with a therapist I had in the past, we were having a conversation about how, you know, I kept saying yes to things and I wouldn't say no to enough things. And she asked me why. And I said, well, I just hate to disappoint people. And she was like, I have something to tell you. She was like, no matter what you do, people will be disappointed. And I know that seems so simple, y'all, and so like basic facts, but I just didn't think of it that way. I just really thought like I can do a bunch of things so that people won't be disappointed. And when she said that, it really freed me. And I think it can also be freeing to realize people are going to judge. People are going to criticize you. People are not going to understand who you are, the decisions you need to make to do what's best for you. There are just going to be people who don't get that, who think that's dumb or stupid or whatever. And they are not the center. They are not why you do what you do or why you should continue to be who you are, you know? And they deserve less energy and less space, the people who do accept you and who do show you love and support. Those people deserve more of your energy. And really, even peeling back the layer of that, that I should accept myself and judge myself less too. So great question. Okay, next question. Boy, y'all came in here with some questions today. Like, I'm glad that I have a therapy appointment today because maybe I should take these questions into therapy and ask my therapist these questions too, okay? Next question says, how did you overcome imposter syndrome? And I'm curious almost to know what is the definition of imposter syndrome. I'm actually going to look one up real quick. Okay, general definition. Imposter syndrome is a psychological pattern in which an individual doubts their skills, talents, or accomplishments and has a persistent internalized fear of being exposed as a fraud. Yo. I actually have three overcome questions right here. And I want to say before I get into any of them that I feel like imposter syndrome, we're also going to talk about writer's block and insecurity. All three of these are things that are going to come up periodically. And I think it's less of like, will you ever get to a place where you're like, oh, whew, I don't think about that anymore. I don't deal with that. Maybe you will. But for most of us, that won't be the case. For most of us, it will mean those thoughts, those feelings will pop up, but it will be more of a question of what is your process for how you deal with those things when they come up? What's your like emotional filing system, if that makes sense, of like, where do you put those things so they go in their proper place instead of being at the center of how you have to interact and live in the world? One of the things that helps me with imposter syndrome is, again, you know, my community and relationships, the people who are close to me. I have amazing friends in general, but I have two friends who, and I was actually just talking to a friend about this. I think in one of these episodes, I want to talk about like the types of friends that I think every person should have. So I'm going to work on that. But we were talking about how it's important to have friends that you know in your personal life, but it's also important to have friends that you know in your professional life as well. And I have two friends who we talk about our personal lives too, but we also talk a lot about work because we work in similar industries, even though we all do different things. And I have two friends that when I get a big meeting, for example, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, you know, sometimes I'll get a big meeting with someone whose work I've admired a long time or who I'm super impressed with. And I will have to call one of those friends and go, who girl, I'm about to have this meeting with, you know, insert this person's name. Give me the talk, you know, and I have really good friends in my life. You know, I have one friend in particular that I can think about and she'll tell me like, hey, you're a badass too. Just because you're going to go in and meet with this person, you know, they might be a badass, but you're a badass too. And I think having people that can speak the truth back to you, because imposter syndrome is inevitably and intrinsically a lie, because it is not speaking to you about who you are. It's speaking to you about how you perceive yourself, how other people perceive you. And sometimes you need somebody who's sort of outside of you that can remind you, hey girl, like you, let me tell you who you are. Let me tell you these things that you've accomplished. Let me tell you these things you've survived and you've made it through. So that's been a big help for me in walking through imposter syndrome. I think also the other thing that helps me with imposter syndrome is just remaining connected to the women that I come from. And I think about my mom and I think about my grandmother and I think about my great grandmother and thinking about the things that they survived, that they went through, that they invested in so that I could, you know, be a podcast host and be a poet and, you know, have, you know, a business with my husband. There are all these things in my life that I would not be able to do if those women had not gone before me. And I think when I remain connected to that, it also helps me to not be so focused on worrying only about myself, but it helps me to remember that I can walk in confidence because of the women who came before me and just sort of widens my view. And I think that can be really helpful with imposter syndrome when we widen the view of who we are, of our place in the world, of the people that worked hard and sacrificed so we could get to the place where we are and be who we are. When I think about my great-grandmother not even being able to graduate high school, but she sacrificed that so that my grandmother could graduate from high school. And my grandmother sacrificed so that my mother could become a nurse and make it to college. And my single mom sacrifice so that my sister and I both could go to college and graduate and be artists and, you know, live our lives according to the things we were passionate about. Like, I wouldn't be able to do this if it weren't for those women. And that sort of helps me remember my confidence is not just, you know, only like in myself and what I have, what I can do in this moment, that I am really standing in the confidence and in the strength of these women before me. So that's been huge, helpful for me. Next question says, how do you overcome writer's block? Womp, womp, womp. Yo, writer's block sucks. Oh, it sucks. I feel like the longest period of time I've had writer's block, I think it was a year and a half. I think so far that's the longest I've gone since I've been an adult anyway, without writing. And I want to normalize writer's block. I think sometimes writer's block comes up for us as writers and we are afraid that it means we will never write. And I think if we normalize that writer's block is going to happen, and writer's block happens for various reasons, but if we normalize it, then we know writer's block is going to come. And instead of me fearing it and like clenching myself, you know, and forcing myself to try to not have writer's block, we can sort of welcome the process of writer's block in a way and maybe do some digging to figure out, can we sense the reasons why we might have writer's block? How can we move past that? Or how can we sit in writer's block until we're no longer blocked, right? So there's a couple of things. Sometimes writer's block happens because we're tired. I can't write when I'm exhausted. And that can mean physically exhausted. That can mean emotionally exhausted. I also think there is a such thing as being creatively exhausted as well. And that doesn't mean you're being exhausted in creative ways, but it means like your creative brain, the part of you that thinks up new ideas, is exhausted. You know, when I finished writing my second book, How to Fix a Broken Record, that was the longest period I had of writer's block after I wrote that book. I didn't write a year and a half. I think that year and a half right there was the stretch. And a part of that was just having creative fatigue in a way that I'd put so much of myself emotionally into this book. And I just kind of had to re-up, you know, and it took me a long time, and some other like really terrible things happened in that same time. So because those terrible things happened, in addition to the book, that just shut me down completely. But it didn't mean anything was wrong with me that I couldn't write. It just meant I needed some time away from it. I needed some time to rest and heal and find my voice, right? Sometimes we have writer's block because we're afraid of what we have to write. Sometimes we have writer's block because we know what we need to write and we fear it. And that you can also walk through. And sometimes for me, when I have that type of writer's block, like if I'm working on a book, for example, and books are always scary to write, I don't care who's writing them, okay? Well, I will say, I don't know about fiction books because I've never written fiction, but writing nonfiction is always scary for me. And most of my friends who write nonfiction books, it's always a scary process. You're always afraid. You would rather run and do anything else for weeks before you want to sit down and like write this book. So sometimes you're going to have writer's block because you're afraid. And there are, you know, little techniques that you can use to help yourself work through that fear. Sometimes for me, it'll just be like, okay, maybe I can't sit down and write like 1,000 words today, but I can sit in my chair for 30 minutes, for 25 minutes, and just write whatever comes out. And then as soon as my alarm goes off, I'm going to get up and like run away from here. So I think you have to dig underneath, you know, what are the reasons why you might be having writer's block? The other thing I will say is sometimes you have writer's block because you are letting your editor and your critic in the room with you when you write, and they are not welcome in the room when you write. You need your editor voice at a later point in the writing process, but at the very beginning, you need to just write. And if we let our editor voice in the room with us, then our editor voice can cause us to have writer's block, because then we're questioning every word we write. We're questioning, did the comma get put in the right place? And should we use the em dash? And should we use a semicolon, you know? And all those questions don't belong in the writer's room. In your personal writer's room, it should be you and your thoughts or your characters, the voice of the story that you want to tell. You let your editor in after you've written. So those are a few things I do to overcome writer's block. Last question, how do you overcome insecurity? Woo! Y'all were not playing with these questions. Y'all really hit me with some Ask Amina questions this time. How do you overcome insecurity? I repeat what I said when I got into these first overcome questions. I don't know if insecurity is something you ever completely overcome. I don't know that there's any human being that's like, I never feel insecure. Over your whole life, you'll have different reasons to feel insecure, different things that you'll be insecure about. I think it's less about getting to a point where you no longer feel insecure at all and more about how you process insecurities when they come up and how you manage your emotions and your thoughts as you walk through that. So no, I have not overcome insecurity and I probably won't in my whole life. But I don't know if this sounds weird or not, but one of the things that has been helpful to me in overcoming insecurity is spending time alone with myself. And I have really had a hard time doing that sometimes because I love engaging with people and I love talking with them. Even when I'm alone, sometimes I'm like, you know, I have all these different apps where I talk to my different friends across the country. And the times that I feel the most insecure, when I give myself some time away from the phone, when I take that time to read or sit just in silence quietly, even sometimes when I'm driving and I'm just by myself driving, listening to music, just spending time with myself, it really helps me to become more secure in who I am and to accept who I am and that I am a beautiful person, that I'm a beautiful human being, and that I'm also imperfect, that I'm gonna mess up, you know, that I'm a human with imperfections, that I hurt, that I get angry, that I make mistakes, and that sometimes I do things that make me so proud of myself, you know? But in a way, our security can't be found externally. We're not going to find our security in our relationships to other people. Other people can't make us feel more secure about ourselves. That's our own work that we have to do. And when we spend time with ourselves, it helps us to get to know ourselves and it helps us to love ourselves. And I think that security in accepting who we are comes from being able to be with who we are and love us in a similar way that we, you know, sort of give that attention to other people, but giving ourselves that same energy. My therapist said something to me when I was talking to her several sessions ago, and I was, you know, telling her how, you know, I really, really love to be a good friend to my friends, to be supportive to them when they are going through a hard thing, to cheer them on when they're going through a great thing. And I told her, you know, due to some things going on in my life, I felt like I just wasn't able to be there for my friends as much as I wanted to be. And she said to me, after evaluating all the things that were going on in my life, she said, I think it's good that you want to be a good friend. But she said, I want you to remember that you can be a good friend to yourself too. And so I wrote that on a post-it note. And every now and then I come across that post-it note and I remember it. So we can begin the journey of becoming more secure in who we are when we remember to be our own friend too. So I hope that's helpful to you all. This was great. You all asked some great questions on this week's edition of hashtag Ask Amina. So I'll come back periodically and we'll do this. And if you have any questions, you can feel free to send me DMs. I am mostly active on Instagram, a little bit on Twitter as well. So feel free to comment on any of the podcast posts that you see and let me know what questions you have. I'd love to address them next time. So every week here on Her with Amina Brown, I like to close the episode by choosing a woman of color and giving her a crown. And what it means when I give her a crown, I just think of a woman of color whose work is amazing, whose personal story really inspires me, and it gives me an opportunity to celebrate her because women of color deserve to be celebrated. And maybe you also know some women of color in your own life that deserve a crown. So I really encourage you to give them a crown, give them their flowers while they can smell them and appreciate them, right? Give them all of the good words and encouragement as you can, because we can't get enough of that, right? So for this week's Give Her a Crown, I want to give a crown to Milk. And Milk is spelled M-I-L-C-K. Milk is a fabulous singer-songwriter. She wrote the song I Can't Keep Quiet and is the founder of the I Can't Keep Quiet movement. I got to hear Milk on the side of stage at the Together Live tour last fall of 2019. In the before times when we were still going to live events, and I was a part of the tour as well. I was performing poetry there, but Milk opened up one of the nights of the tour with her music, and just hearing her there playing at the piano, hearing her amazing voice singing was one of the most beautiful things I witnessed on the tour. So I've been following her ever since. And even in these times now that we are in a pandemic, as well as in an uprising, and watching the ways that Milk is using her voice and her music to uplift us, to speak the truth to us, to remind us to care for ourselves and care for each other. I just think that's beautiful. Her newest single, Somebody's Beloved, or it could be Beloved, is out now wherever you like to stream your music. So make sure you follow Milk. You can get all this information in the show notes on aminabrown.com/her with Amina. You can get a link to Milk's website there, as well as information about how you can follow her, stream her music, download her music, support her music. She's amazing. Yes, yes, Milk, give her a crown. Her with Amina Brown is produced by Matt Owen for Soul Graffiti Productions. As a part of the Seneca Women Podcast Network in partnership with iHeartRadio. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast.